Our final speaker, and then we'll have time for a panel discussion, and I hope you're thinking of some good questions to challenge our panel with, is Dr. Mary Hahn. She is a professor and chair of the Department of Surgery at Stanford. Dr. Hahn.
Thank you, Dr. Matthews, Dr. McLacy. So I always say there's two people on the call schedule, me and not me. And so these are stories from me nights. And I have no disclosures. So this is lesson three and the third panelist. You can guess what it is, location, location. Okay, now for the final part of today's lesson, location. All right, so how do we think of location from a surgeon's perspective? So preoperative localization of where the bleeding is before you take someone to surgery is ideal, right? Intraoperative localization is challenging. Oftentimes we're asked to, especially before double balloon enteroscopy, to do intraoperative enteroscopy. The blood can reflux back. It's hard to know really where the blood is starting with peristalsis as well. And then postoperative GI bleeding after your surgical exploration is defeating. So we don't get asked to get involved in these patients very often, and often when we are asked is when the patient is actively bleeding. This is just a single institution study where they looked at all patients admitted to their hospital with a diagnosis of GI bleed over a one-year period. And you can see the majority of them did not have localization, either they, because of patient factors, they didn't intervene with localization endoscopy because the bleeding stopped, or they weren't able to find a source. But most of the time when they could find a source, it was upper or lower. And of those patients that were admitted, only 6% underwent some type of therapeutic intervention, and no patients underwent a surgical intervention in that one-year series for their patients who are admitted for GI bleed. So this isn't something that we get called upon as surgeons to intervene on as much as we used to. So I'm going to focus mostly on small bowel bleeding because I think it's challenging to diagnose and it's really challenging to localize depending upon the etiology. Obviously, if there's a tumor, that's a good idea of where the bleeding could be come from. Capsule endoscopy, as you've heard, may identify a lesion, but you does not really help you localize where that lesion is, and it doesn't offer therapeutic intervention. And I think, like you heard, CT angiography, if the patient is bleeding, can definitely provide you better localization than angiography itself if you're going to have to take that patient to the operating room. We've already seen the slide. I cut out the rare guys, but age can help tell you which way to go. Angioectasias, I think, are one of the hard ones for us to manage in terms of localization. There's no palpable lesion, and they're often in medically ill patients who develop them. So small bowel tumors, most of the ones that I have taken care of usually have some type of provocative agent on board, like patients who are on antiplatelets, anticoagulants, and develop intermittent recurrent GI bleeds. The bleeding often stops and starts, and cross-sectional imaging, obviously, in this setting can be quite useful for both the diagnosis of the underlying etiology. And especially if the enteroscopy or capsule is normal. And then surgery in those situations is diagnostic and often therapeutic. So these are a couple things that that we encounter in the operating room that may bleed, especially with provocation. So gastrointestinal stromal tumors are quite vascular, and they may ulcerate into the mucosa, and they often will present with a pretty decent GI bleed that will often stop spontaneously. And this was a patient of mine who had bled, and she was one of the nurses in our clinic. She had intermittent GI bleeds like once every couple months and had been scoped above and below and had a video endoscopy where they thought maybe they saw a small bowel lesion, but they thought maybe it was an AVM, and she wasn't actively bleeding. And then she came in bleeding again. We took her to the OR to do an intraoperative endoscopy and did a laparotomy and found this and realized she never had cross-sectional imaging. So make sure that cross-sectional imaging is done in patients with occult GI bleeds that aren't otherwise localized. I've also had patients who bleed from carcinoids. It's more rare because I think the tumors are more likely to obstruct or cause other issues than bleeding. But patients on antiplatelets in particular, there may be a mucosal lesion associated with it that could bleed. These are usually obviously easy to find in the operating room too. Other things that I've seen bleed and diagnosed in the OR is a small bowel lymphoma and obviously small bowel adenocarcinoma. So diverticula, the small bowel can bleed just like diverticula, the sigmoid colon, and jejunal diverticula, I think, are particularly difficult to manage surgically because they are often multiple. And they're very proximal, close to the ligament attrites. And this is something that's reachable with an endoscope and I think would be a great use for endoscopic clip. And we can ask our colleague here later if he agrees with that. And maybe IR could be another way to reach these, but this is something I think you probably don't want to end up in the operating room for if you diagnose this. Where we do end up in the operating room sometimes are patients with a bleeding Meckel's diverticulum. This is a patient of mine who had intermittent GI bleeding, had iron deficiency anemia, had a capsule endoscopy that showed the diverticulum as well as the small bowel ulcer. Let's see if I can show you, it was right there. And they also had a technetium 99 scan that showed the heterotopic gastric mucosa. We took this patient to the operating room and he had been on PPI, so actually his acute bleeding had stopped, but did a small bowel resection, and you can see here is the diverticulum coming off the antimesenteric border, and here is this persistent ulcer in the small bowel. So GI bleeding with a Meckel's diverticulum, the ulcer is usually in the normal small bowel, not in the diverticulum. So in the adult literature, the typical teaching is that you would do a small bowel resection so to ensure that you resect the ulcer along with the diverticulum. However, in the pediatric literature, their recommendation is just to do a diverticulectomy because once you remove the source of the ectopic acid secretion, that the small bowel ulcer will heal. Vascular malformations, have you heard, are some of the more challenging GI bleeds to diagnose because they're intermittent. The detection of the lesions is not always easy. So dilophoid lesions, we see them most often in the stomach, but they can occur anywhere throughout the GI tract. This is an enlarged submucosal vessel, and it usually presents with a massive GI bleed, not a subtle GI bleed. And they are very amenable to endoscopic treatment if they are reachable. But if that's not available, then the typical surgical treatment would be a wedge resection. So ways to try and diagnose some of the small bowel bleeding, if you're in the operating room and you know it's in the small bowel and it's been diagnosed but not quite localized and it's actively bleeding, would be to use bowel clamps and kind of successfully clamp different areas of the small bowel and see if the small bowel seems to be expanding. And then potentially either doing a deep enteroscopy with your gastroenterologist transorally or doing an enterotomy and doing intraoperative endoscopy to help localize lesions as well. Gastric varices is another cause of GI bleeding that sometimes can be treated surgically. It's often due to splenic vein thrombosis secondary to chronic pancreatitis. Most of these will be treated with endoscopic ablation. However, if that fails, we sometimes will consider splenectomy. This is not an easy splenectomy, as you can imagine, if it's somebody who's had significant enough pancreatitis to have splenic vein thrombosis. And in this circumstance, I would probably recommend doing preoperative splenic artery embolization just to try and decrease the amount of bleeding during surgery. Here are the infamous AVMs, angiotasias, angiodysplasias, and other names. These, I think, are the most challenging small bowel lesions for the surgeons to treat. You can't localize them. If you're doing intraoperative endoscopy, we do so much manipulation of the bowel. I don't think it's easy to do it laparoscopically. It's almost difficult to advance the scope open just because of dealing with the small bowel mesentery. And all the manipulation of the small bowel can cause little hematomas of the mucosa and things like that. So it's it can be challenging. And then often you're seeing these lesions, and if there's not actively bleeding, you don't know which ones to treat and which ones are truly AVMs versus trauma that you may have caused. But these are, if they're actively bleeding, you can successfully localize them. They can then be either treated, if you're doing intraoperative endoscopy, with an endoscopic approach, or a small bowel resection of the area. Another GI bleed that we treat with surgery, and our Cameron's ulcers at the hiatal hernia. Patients can present with iron deficiency anemia, thought to be due to impinging of the diaphragmatic crura on the stomach. So these will almost always get better with PPIs and iron supplements. And most patients that I treat surgically for this are patients who are symptomatic otherwise from their hernia and their reflux. And also, the other circumstance might be patients who need to be on a blood thinner, whether or not they should undergo elective repair of their hiatal hernia. And I was just going to mention a few zebras of things as a surgeon that I've had to treat and our colleagues have had to treat. And these are bleeding into the GI tract. So mostly we think of GI bleeding as being a GI source. And these could be an arterial biliary fistula from a patient maybe who has some type of intervention, liver biopsy, developed some type of a fistula between the hepatic artery and the biliary tract. Aortoduodenal fistulas, we don't see those. They're rare, and we don't see them as much anymore with all the endovascular repairs. I've taken care or seen patients who presented with GI bleeds who've had a transgastric necrosectomy, and then they get a splenic artery pseudoaneurysm that bled into the stomach through the necrosectomy site. And so not all blood comes from the GI tract. And then I want to talk about a case that I have because I think we're going to see this a little bit more. And this was a 42-year-old man who had a sleeve gastrectomy complicated by a leak at the proximal end of a staple line. He was treated with an IR drain of the leak and an endoluminal stent. He presented to an emergency room near my hospital with an episode of hematemesis. He had no further bleeding. He was hemostatically stable. He was discharged, and 6 hours later presented to our emergency room with massive hematemesis, audible bleeding. And the initial EGD that they showed a large amount of clot in the stomach that they were having difficulty clearing and really unable to identify the source of bleeding, and the patient developed abdominal compartment syndrome, so we ended up in the operating room. And ultimately, I mean, this patient, I think, had been through several massive transfusion protocols before we got to the operating room, but the patient died before we could control the bleeding. And we had a cross clamp on the aorta. And at autopsy, what they found is this ulcer here in the esophagus. And this here, it doesn't show quite as well because the stomach's open, but it was where the leak from the staple line was. And then when they took the stent, which actually the stent was dislodged when he was scoped before we took him to the operating room, the stent was dislodged, and you see the stent was what had created that ulcer. And then that ulcer here tracked to a hole in the thoracic aorta. And so you can see here's the tract. And there's been several case reports of aortoenteric fistulas from esophageal stents. And more likely in patients that we might see who have been after sleeve gastrectomy or Roux-en-Y gastrogenostomy leaks, because there's the way I think that it angles the stent that it causes some back pressure on the aorta. So if you put stents in those circumstances, don't leave them in very long. So I think what a surgeon brings to this very complex and challenging issue is knowledge of the anatomy both inside and outside the GI tract, and understanding of prior surgical history and the contribution of that. And I think many times we bring a cure for the patient. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Han, and thank you to all the panelists for their very clear presentations. We invite all of you to come up with questions. There are several microphones. If I see someone in the distance, here it is, microphone there on the left. Please go ahead. I think we need the microphone left front being activated.
I think it's on now. In your investigation of occult GI bleed, do you differentiate the patient that we often get referred for the recurrent iron deficiency anemia who's asymptomatic from the occult GI bleed who obviously could have recurrent melena or hematochezia? And do you investigate them the same way?
Dr. Plesko.
So that is a different patient population that we think of, because those are generally symptomatic with iron deficiency as compared to the occult GI bleeders. But typically the evaluation will be the same. But we'll start with diagnostic endoscopy and colonoscopy with attempts at visualization of the ileum as well as the distal duodenum and jejunum. And then if that's negative, then proceed with the video capsule endoscopy. So we do approach them the same, although they are different. They are considered to be different.
So one of the issues I practice in Canada, and video capsule endoscopy is almost unavailable. And you know, we get pushed a lot by the hematologist to investigate these patients. So again, we'll get these patients that have been scoped up and down a few times. You know, you do the CT enterography, do everything other than the video capsule endoscopy. Should we be saying that it's standard of care now to investigate these patients that have these recurrent anemias?
I think the literature would bear that out as an appropriate measure of standard of care to fully interrogate the small intestine. So, I think these other modalities are very effective, but in order to get a complete evaluation, the video capsule is a lot easier on the patient to interrogate the entire small bowel versus either a push enteroscopy or deep enteroscopy. Even if you're going in the antegrade or retrograde fashion, you're not necessarily going to be able to completely evaluate that. And it's certainly obviously riskier for the patient to have these two lengthy procedures with the rate of perforation. The significant complication from video capsule endoscopy is capsular retention in a patient who may have a stricture or a tumor in the small bowel. And then that's actually a good thing, because then you can localize where that is. So it's not necessarily a bad thing if a capsule gets stuck, because then I can ask my surgical colleagues to go in and take it out and resect the area of problem.
Thank you.
Microphone up front to my right.
Yeah, Asata from Lehi Clinic. In these days with so much technical advances, is there still a place for a blind subtotal colectomy for an unstable bleeding patient?
Dr. Hahn.
I think that patient would often go to IR first if they could not be localized, and if they're unstable, depending upon how unstable they are, right? But often we will send that patient to IR if they're available. And again, you just don't want to be in a circumstance where you take out the colon and the patient's still bleeding. So I think you'd have to be pretty certain that it was a lower GI bleed before you did that. And I always remember being taught in residency, just make sure it's not something in the rectum.
Dr. Matthews?
I was going to ask the panel, Doug, when do you get the surgeon involved? Many of these cases, you're going to be able to sort out and solve. What's your threshold for involving the surgical team? And then sort of a toss-up question out there, how does the approach to these patients differ with the time of day or the day of the week?
So our threshold to involve the surgeon is usually when it's becoming a very massive bleed, number one. Or number two, if the bleeding is we've done multiple investigations, including our enteroscopies, our capsule endoscopies, our repeated endoscopies and colonoscopies. If we're unable to then discover a source in our radiology colleagues have not been able to identify a source, we will then consult our surgical colleagues with the approach of doing intraoperative endoscopy. And as Mary alluded to, that's a very challenging thing to do. Number one is timing of getting OR time and endoscopy time at the same moment, and then deciding which way to go, making an enterotomy, and then going upstream and then downstream with manipulation of bowel. We often see mucosal trauma within the lumen of the small bowel, making it sometimes impossible to determine whether this is a hematoma or an AVM. Sometimes we'll find something that we may have missed someplace else, but these are very difficult lesions. And oftentimes we'll be treating these hematomas, which we think may be AVMs, with APC or with BiCAP when they probably are not necessarily clinically relevant. Time of day and time of week, after midnight and on weekends, we always get the surgeons involved.
We're no surprised.
I was going to ask maybe Susan, you want to comment on the issue of the staging and sequencing of the radiology workup and the efficiency that happens on nights and weekends?
Sure. So in terms of interventional radiology becoming involved, at least at my present and past institutions, they've always involved us pretty early in the process. And we typically consult on the patient and then make recommendations for imaging. My preference is to get a CTA in this day and age so that I can get information quickly and get the patient while they're actually bleeding into a, what I would consider a definitive management place. The I personally have had less good fortune with the nuclear medicine studies because they do take time, regardless of the time of day. So, and sometimes, you know, sometimes that's beneficial, but sometimes that's not. In the era of, you know, the most hospitals, at least in the Boston area, are considering hospitals to be 24/7 institutions. So I think that's, it tends to be less relevant these days. And we're pretty much available if someone's bleeding any time of the day or night. They tend to call us first.
Susan, in the example that you showed, that particular patient had magnificent pictures. That patient had a tagged RBC first, had a multifacic CTA second, and then had an angiogram third. Is that a routine sequence, or are there situations where you can skip one or the other?
So in that circumstance, the patient had a tagged cell first. And then I don't think I pointed it out actually on the non-contrast CT, but the patient had an extensive history of peripheral vascular disease with extensive vascular stenting in the iliacs. And there was concern that there could be occlusions of the SMA, IMA, and or the celiac. And so we wanted to get a better understanding of their anatomy before we went in to do an intervention. So that's why the CTA was actually performed in that circumstance. And if you look at the non-contrast images, you can see that the aorta is heavily calcified. And further, the other reason why that's important is to, you know, when you have a discussion about the risks and benefits with the patient, there's always concern for thromboembolic complications, particularly in those circumstances. And we were concerned whether we would actually even be able to get into the SMA or the IMA. And so it helps us kind of plan for, you know, what catheters we're going to use, if we can actually get there, is our access going to be right femoral, left femoral, radial. So it gives us a lot more information to plan the and optimize our approach.
First, microphone on my left.
Hi, Greg Jaron from Winslow, Arizona. So, Dr. Ahuro, I appreciate your presentation. I noticed that when you said when you embolize somebody, that you have about a 4% chance of infarction. But is it? Wouldn't it be even higher for the small bowel? I know in training we actually would go in after an embolization within 24 hours just to resect that portion. What's your experience?
So in my experience, the vast majority of times that we see bleeding in the small bowel is from angiodysplasias. Mm-hmm. Angiodysplasias typically will have multiple arterial feeders that prevent us from embolizing very distally. It's very difficult to embolize a larger segment of small bowel. And that's why we consider angiodysplasia to be better treated by endoscopy or surgery, because the risk of small bowel infarction goes up so much. Occasionally, we'll be pushed, given the other clinical circumstances, to do embolization for angiodysplasia. Some people have described using glue, and that can be less traumatic to the mucosa, but again, can still cause problems with ischemia and probably explains the concept of going in for a look afterwards to resect that segment of bowel. Typically, what I do is when we do an embolization is, you know, we follow them for a few days to check their groin and make sure they don't have any peritoneal signs. But even incidentally seeing, you can see ischemia in the colon, even if it's not clinically apparent on exam.
Thank you.
Now, before others come to the microphone, let me just go back for a second to the question of the total abdominal colectomy. And I think that Dr. Hahn already said it. You really need to be sure that the bleeding is coming from the colon prior to proceed with that. And I think that nowadays that procedure is hopefully rare and rarely needed. due to the advance in radiology and endoscopy and so forth. But if the patient is in extremis and you really have to take that patient to the operating room, thinking, again, you need to be sure that it's bleeding from the colon. How do you do that? Well, certainly a couple of things are mandatory, at least in my book, and I'm going to ask Dr. Hahn and Dr. Matthews to comment and augment. Obviously, you need to rule out an upper GI hemorrhage with an upper endoscopy or other ways. And second, I think it's also important to do a flexible sigmoidoscopy, or at least a proctosigmoidoscopy, to rule out the presence of bleeding sources in the distal 10 centimeters, 12 centimeters of rectum, like a solitary rectal ulcer or a cancer or whatever. It would be very ironic to do an abdominal colectomy and leaving the rectum behind where the source of bleeding was. And in general, in these particular cases, they're usually in extremis, and therefore, most likely, you're not going to reestablish the gastrointestinal continuity and bring out an ileostomy and close the rectal pouch, which then helps in case, the unfortunate case of recurrent bleeding, you know, where it comes. We shouldn't go to that extent, but that's another thing to think about. Dr. Hahn?
Yeah, I agree with you, definitely, that it, making sure the rectum is clear before you take out the colon. And, you know, in our debrief on that patient that I talked about with the esophageal stent that became a fistula, we were having to make a decision in the emergency room, OR versus IR. And obviously we didn't know where he was bleeding from. We would have preferred to go to IR until he developed this abdominal compartment syndrome. And we weren't hardly able to ventilate him. But I think many of our hospitals are developing these hybrid ORs, and in our debrief, we talked about we should have been in the hybrid OR, and it just local things. It wasn't really where IR was, but I think in the future that might help us in these situations where you're finding yourself with a patient who's in extremis and bleeding, and just to have all tools available to you, the surgeon, your interventional radiologist, to localize, resect, whatever you need to do.
Jeff?
Yeah, you know, anecdotally, people have described bringing out an ileostomy and waiting to see whether the blood comes out from above or below in those cases of recurrent, occult bleeding. You don't know if it's coming from the colon source or not. I wanted to ask about the situation that you sometimes see, which are these sort of elderly patients who probably have multiple angiodysplasias, often associated with aortic valve disease. Whatever happened to pharmacotherapy for that, estrogens and other approaches to that situation? Doug, is there any new information on that?
There's no new information. It is one of the things that we will do if we have no other alternatives. We also have used octreotide in the past for these patients, and all with variable success. There's no new agents at this point in time that are available, and no better data.
The patient that presents with extensive disease, whatever it is definitely a major challenge on top of all the other challenges that we encounter with occult GI bleeding. I'll come to you in a second. Dr. Hahn already mentioned the patient with multiple diverticula of the jejunum. I can think of a patient with several sites of Crohn's disease. How do we approach those patients in terms of localizing, which endoscopically is very difficult with multiple diverticula or multiple stenosis and from Crohn's disease, you probably cannot reach at a certain point, beyond a certain point, capsules get stuck. And we surgeons then are faced with not knowing exactly where the patient is bleeding from if you end up at surgery. Thoughts?
My thoughts, if they're a patient who stops and starts their bleeding, you have to operate on them when they're bleeding, when they're actively bleeding, or you're really not going to be able to find it. And I think for the jejunal diverticulum, it's just, you know, if it's bleeding, otherwise I would leave it alone. I wouldn't do anything with it. And if it bled and then stopped, I wouldn't do anything with it either.
So at my previous institution, we had a lot of a very large cohort of stem cell transplant patients. And they can obviously present many different clinical challenges. And one of the challenges we encountered not infrequently were patients who had GVHD of the small bowel with bleeding. And there are some case reports where people will deliver intra-arterial prednisone, and that can also help just diminish the amount of mucosal abnormality as well and help with the bleeding. But from an embolization standpoint, that's not a good candidate.
Front microphone to my left.
Is there any place for conservative management of a patient who has been reasonably investigated, no cause has been found, including capsule endoscopy, who is reasonably well and stable on long-term and IM therapy?
Case for intraoperative endoscopy?
No, no, the question is there a role for conservative management, just observe, in a patient that you've done everything, diagnostic, and you don't know where the source of bleeding is, but the patient, although maybe anemic, can be maintained on iron supplements or potential the occasional blood transfusion. Where is your level of tolerance for this approach that obviously is unsettling?
My level of tolerance is high for that because not all iron deficiency anemia is occult GI loss, so I would not operate on that patient.
No, I beg your pardon. My question is not about surgery. It's about conservative treatment.
Could you please repeat it again? I couldn't hear it.
Is there any place for managing the patient who has been investigated, no cause has been found, and placing them on iron and following them up?
I think the answer is yes, that there is a place for that conservative treatment if indeed after an extensive workup you don't really have a source, yet the patient doesn't have a profound anemia and the anemia can be managed with iron supplements. Obviously that patient needs to be followed very closely because at any time they have a massive bleed or an increase in the iron anemia. Jeff, any?
We see these patients from time to time who've bled on and off for years, and if the pattern is not catastrophic bleeding, it's a small amount of bleeding, it stops and you can't find it out, it's obviously an individual decision in the context of the patient. The risks of laparotomy, intraoperative endoscopy to try to definitively solve it, versus the possibility that the pattern will somehow deteriorate or a lesion that is more ominous, say a missed cancer, is neglected. You know, so I think there's always going to be exceptions around the on the margins here where you have to individualize for a patient. And I've certainly seen patients like that. They have prohibitive medical risks, maybe a hostile abdomen, and you do the best you can with it. But it just depends upon the pattern. You know, if this is a pattern that's gone on for months or years and you know, you're fairly sure that it's stable and that things are not progressing. I can imagine a patient like that from time to time. But I think it wouldn't be the rule.
Thank you. Susan, you mainly talked about overt bleeding and the way to diagnose that radiologically. Is there a role for radiology in the occult bleeding? Now, already, Mary Hahn already mentioned that you need to do cross-sectional imaging to at least rule out the presence of a mass, a gist or a tumor that may be obvious on radiology. Are there any other roles for radiology in occult bleeding?
Well, I think
you should talk into the microphone.
So I think the short answer is yes. I would typically, in the situation for truly occult bleeding, I think a CTA, really good dynamic study with a non-contrast study and no oral contrast is really helpful. It can help diagnose other etiologies for the occult bleeding, whether it's tumor or angiodysplasias or any of the innumerable causes of bleeding, probably greater than 90% of the time. The other issue, you can always use nuclear medicine for the Meckel's cases. It tends to not be as useful if someone's not actively bleeding, but for something that's truly occult, I think CT is going to be your way to go.
And other question at this point for the surgeons. Let's assume you have a patient that comes to your office with a status post, even a massive bleed or a notable bleed. This point stable, no bleeding. you do a thorough workup and you find a lesion. It could be a Meckel diverticulum with a gastric mucosa. It could be an angiodysplasia somewhere else. A gist, I think, I will not put a gist into this into this question. What is your appetite to operate on a patient like this when you have demonstrated a lesion, but not necessarily that that was the lesion that was bleeding?
I think if it was a Meckel's with proven heterotopic gastric mucosa, I would take the Meckel's out for sure. You know, they're often younger patients. They really don't have any other etiology for a bleed versus we see the AVMs in the older, sicker patients. So I think it would be two different patient populations. The AVM, if it wasn't bleeding, I'd leave it alone. And I actually have a quick question for Jeff. It would be great if you commented on that too, your thoughts. But for Doug, about how frequently would topically treating ectasia with APC or bipolar, how often will it rebleed? And so if I'm in surgery, should I endoscopically treat it or should I just cut it out?
These do rebleed. It's a lower likelihood that they're going to rebleed, so probably 95% of the time we're going to get good control, but that does leave 5% of the time. So if you can find it surgically, cut it out.
Okay.
That would be exactly what I would say. I thought you were going to ask something slightly different, Fabrizio. I thought you were going to ask the question of laparoscopic versus open exploration for some of these situations, whether you're likely to see something from the outside of the bowel versus what the usual situation is you can't see anything.
That was my next question, but I'm going to make it even more difficult. Okay. Well, I think that let me answer after we hear from the question here on the front microphone to my left.
In the investigation of the occult GI bleed, is there an added role to CT enterography or MR enterography in looking for lesions, or CT is enough?
We don't typically use CT and MR enterography as much. Certainly you can do that. I think probably having our endoscopic evaluations is usually a little bit more helpful because they can also do definitive management at that time. But it can also aid in the diagnosis and point treatment for our gastroenterology colleagues as well.
So to answer Dr. Matthew's question about do you do it laparoscopically or do you do it open, I think you're in a situation that is very challenging, a situation that has been prolonged over time of occult bleeding or bleeding on and off. So if you take that patient to the operating room, you need to do everything possible to make sure that you take care of the problem. So I have nothing against starting laparoscopically. And occasionally laparoscopically you find lesions, like for instance that gist that was presented, that at that point you do it and you know that you obviously run the bowel, making sure that this is not just an incidental finding, making sure that there are no other findings that would question whether the gist was the real reason of the bleeding. But if by any chance laparoscopy obviously is simple to see masses, you're not going to see angiodysplasias or things that are mucosal. If laparoscopy does not give a 100% clear view of what you're looking at, I think I have no hesitation to open that patient because, again, that patient is as frustrated as you are in terms of not really knowing where the bleeding is, and you want to face the patient in the postoperative period saying, I've done everything possible. And actually, that everything possible, I'm going to ask all of you at this point how you do your enteroscopies intraoperatively. I'm going to come out myself saying how I do it. I really don't like to do enterotomies because I find that it's very difficult when you insufflate the small bowel, spillage is very difficult to contain there. So I try desperately to have an enteroscopy done transorally. Do you agree, Mary?
So I think it depends on the skill of your gastroenterologist and their availability too. So I've done them both ways. I think they're both frustrating. You do so much small bowel manipulation and the patient gets a horrible ileus afterward. But if I make an enterotomy, so again, you want to be there when they're actively bleeding, so you can figure out what the definitive lesion is, and then start partway down from where you see the blood, because sometimes the blood will go retrograde depending upon how fast they're bleeding, and make an aneurotomy there. Go proximal, just make sure it's not there, and then go distal and hope you find it. And that's what I've done. I just do a purse string, use clamps to try and minimize any spillage. And I haven't had much issues with spillage with that.
I think the problem that happens, whether you start laparoscopy, you do intraoperative endoscopy, is that you, by a factor of 10, you exacerbate the problem that Doug Plesko mentioned, which is this trauma, and then you can't tell the trauma from the actual bleeding site. And just every time it sounds great in theory and the bowel looks beat up.
I have one question, but I'd like to make a comment before we go to your question. So hold your thought for a second. Yes, we're traumatizing the bowel. And what about this spiral endoscopy? It looks like a something that Leonardo da Vinci would have designed going into the bowel this way, like a Roto-Rooter. Is it really gentle, or does it create bleeding as well?
So I personally have not used the motorized version. I've used the handheld version, which was very traumatic. I'm told by Paul Ackerman, who is the sort of big proponent of this, and David Carlock has used this a bit as well, and they've used this clinically in South America multiple times, that there's less trauma associated with the motorized spiral than with the mechanical spiral. So it's an elegant system. It's not commercially available. I'm not sure what's holding it up, but it looks
trauma. Yes, microphone up front on my left.
Mitch Cahan from UMass Worcester. I'd really like to counter the suggestion that intraoperative endoscopy or enteroscopy is not safe and has problems. We've had a lot of success at UMass. We reported, I think, the largest series in the Journal of Gastrointestinal Surgery just this year of 112 patients over the last 10 years, 67 of those were for occult GI bleeding. And I would strongly encourage people to really develop a very close relationship with a gastroenterologist. We have David Cave at our institution. What we do is people who've undergone the gamut of upper and lower and many, many transfusions, and they were sent to us from all over the region, not found to have a source. They come to the operating room, we do a diagnostic laparoscopy. If we don't find anything obvious, and by the way, the Meckel scan is often not helpful, because I've had patients who've had heterotopic mucosa who have negative Meckel scans. If we don't find anything, then we make a 6-centimeter incision above the umbilicus, and we exteriorize the small bowel, and we make an incision, we do an David Cave or one of his colleagues does an intraoperative enteroscopy, and we've been very successful. Yes, there are challenges in terms of people who have multifocal disease with AVMs, but I wouldn't, I would think that intraoperative enteroscopy has become a very formidable part of your war chest in terms of dealing with these patients, and unfortunately, there are only a handful of centers in the country that offer this, but I would encourage people to, open up to that as a part of the toolkit.
No, I think we all agree on that. I don't think that any of us mentioned that intraoperative enteroscopy was dangerous. I think that
the mucosal trauma. We don't really, seem to have that much of a problem with that. I mean, it's a risk, but
I think that obviously you need to develop a skill in doing that. Yeah, I agree completely, but it is indeed a very good diagnostic tool in the armamentarium of a GI surgeon. Any additional questions from the audience or potentially from the panelists? I heard that. I think we're done. So thank you very much for staying with us.